This podcast contains adult themes and graphic violence. Listener discretion is advised.
A commercial-free version of this podcast is available on Patreon for $1 per month. Patreon.com/Beyond Contempt Podcast. Just a quick note. I want to thank everyone for all the case submissions. Keep them coming. Thanks to Nate for recommending the Samuel Scheinbein case for episode 39. Listeners seem to enjoy it. Also know that if you've left me feedback via social media or email, I've read it. I read everything. I don't always have the time or the capacity to respond, but know that I've heard you. I'm Renee, and this is Beyond Contempt True Crime. This case has a little bit of everything. California surf culture, Hollywood celebrity culture, trust funds, bounty hunters, and GHB. You're listening to episode 40, Andrew Lester. Max Factor Sr. was from Congress, Poland. He made wigs and did makeup for Russian stage productions in the late 19th century. Max emigrated to the United States in 1902 and made his way to California, which was developing into a home for the motion picture industry. He worked as a makeup and hairstylist for movie stars. Max was an innovator and invented a type of face makeup for the film set that would not melt under hot movie lights. He continued to be a leader in the industry and invented pancake makeup, which evened out the roughest of complexions. Stars from Joan Crawford to Bette Davis flocked to work with Max, and they often would visit his Hollywood salon. Max Factor became a household name in the world of retail beauty products, and American women were eagerly buying those products. When Max died in 1938, his son Max Jr. ran the company and continued to innovate. The company went public in the 1960s. Over time, there was decreasing family involvement with mergers, deaths, and other interests and pursuits. Max Factor's heirs sold the company for hundreds of millions of dollars, securing generational wealth for everyone in the extended Factor family. Elizabeth Lester was part of the Factor family. Her mother was named Frida, and Frida was Max Factor Sr.'s daughter. Therefore, Max Factor Sr. was Elizabeth's grandfather. Elizabeth and Henry Lester had a son named Andrew, who was born on December 15, 1963. When Andrew was only 10, his grandmother, Frida, set up a $3.1 million trust fund for him. Her intention was to set him up for success in life. Andrew was raised in swank Malibu, California, and he attended exclusive schools in West Los Angeles. He had a unique life, in that few kids grow up with Barbra Streisand as their next-door neighbor. Andrew and his sister lost their father to cancer, so they were raised by their mother and a nanny. Andrew was not interested in studying when he attended Santa Barbara City College, so he dropped out. He was far more interested in skateboarding, skiing, or catching waves on a surfboard. In 1981, Elizabeth Lester bought her son a modest bungalow in Muscle Shoals, California, for $170,000. Muscle Shoals is in between Ventura and Santa Barbara, right off the Pacific Coast Highway. It was a well-known spot for surfers to catch waves. Andrew was satisfied with the structure of his life. He didn't have to hold a job. He surfed most days, and then lived off the $55,000 per year allowance from his trust fund. Andrew tried his hand at selling real estate, and also tried trading stocks. But those efforts were fleeting, because he could walk out his front door with a surfboard and catch a picturesque wave. Elizabeth Lester didn't understand her son's lack of work ethic. She was a person who was big on philanthropy and spent most of her time and money working for animal rights charities while her son was hanging 10 on the beach. This would always be a point of contention between mother and son. Life really didn't change for Andrew Lester after he became a father. His son Connor arrived in 1991 and his daughter Quinn in 1994. Andrew broke up with his girlfriend, Valeria Balderrama, but was still financially supporting his kids and remained in their lives. Elizabeth Luster also ensured that she remained in her grandkids' lives and that they were financially well cared for. She bought Valeria and the kids an expensive home in the Pacific Palisades, where $1 million gets you a Cracker Jack box. Andrew Luster was a guy who always had girlfriends hanging around him. It was something he bragged about, and he gravitated towards women who were significantly younger than him. Andrew was fit at 200 pounds on a 6'1" body. He had a square, symmetrical jaw, blue-green eyes, a full head of brown hair, and a goatee. Some might have called him conventionally attractive. Truthfully, in the summer of 2000, Andrew Luster was a stereotypical middle-aged 37-year-old man trolling college bars in Isla Vista or Santa Barbara for young ladies who were almost half his age. Carrie was a 21-year-old student who went out to have a good time in Santa Barbara on July 13, 2000. Carrie, her boyfriend, and her friends pre-gamed at her apartment, then went out to State Street for dinner and drinks. The area was popular amongst the college-age crowd. The group stopped at a place called Madison's Sports Grill. Carrie had a few cocktails, including a Cosmopolitan and two Long Island iced teas. She got in a fight with her boyfriend, then she and her friend David broke off from the group and went to another bar called O'Malley's. By that time, Carrie and her friend David were stumbling around on the dance floor. On the same night, Andrew Luster was at O'Malley's bar. He was standing on the sidelines, watching Carrie and David. Their level of inebriation was evident, so he approached the dancing couple and offered to get the male a glass of water to help sober him up. David was struggling to stand, so he accepted the water from Luster. Carrie and David shared the water, and the night seemed to slip away into an easy haze. After Carrie drank the water, she remembered little of what happened the rest of the night. Carrie, David, Luster, and Luster's friend all got into Luster's SUV, and they drove to a Santa Barbara strip club. The bouncer took one look at Carrie and David and would not let them in due to how drunk they were. Everyone got back in the SUV, and Luster drove them to his Muscle Shoals bungalow. When Luster looked in his rearview mirror, he saw Carrie performing oral sex on David. Later on, David would try to piece together his night. He wasn't certain exactly what happened, but thought he might have had intercourse with Carrie in the SUV because she lifted her dress and straddled him in the back seat. On the beach in Muscle Shoals, Carrie took off her dress and went skinny dipping in the ocean. Afterward, the three men and Carrie went inside Luster's home. She went to take a shower, Luster joined her, and they had intercourse. Carrie believed that after the shower, Luster gave her another drink. She found the drink to be refreshing, but a wave of heat hit Carrie hard. This led her to believe that the drink was drugged. The feeling was so intense that she called Luster out in that moment and wanted to know what he put in her drink. He told Carrie that it was liquid ecstasy, which was the street name for a drug called gamma-hydroxybutyric acid, or GHB. Another street name for the substance was the date rape drug. Carrie and Luster had intercourse again. Carrie woke up the next morning on Luster's bed and had no clothes on. She really wanted to get out of there, but Luster had intercourse with her one last time. David was passed out in another room in the house. Carrie's memory was fuzzy, but she thought she might have had an encounter with Luster's friend as well. In the morning, Luster dropped Carrie and David off at her apartment, and he slipped her his telephone number. Carrie really thought about that evening and discussed the sequence of events with her friends. Her uneasy feeling about Andrew Luster was enough for her to go to the police on July 17th, and she filed a criminal complaint of drug-induced rape against him. When law enforcement tested Carrie for GHB, the result came back negative. This wasn't unusual, as GHB quickly leaves a person's system in a matter of hours, and negative tests are common. Law enforcement had Carrie phone Luster while they recorded the call. They wanted her to get Luster to admit what he did, During the conversation, Lester told Carrie that he gave her Liquid X. The police got what they needed from the phone call. And on the next day, they descended on the Muscle Shoals bungalow. Andrew Lester was arrested for using a narcotic to commit rape. When they searched his home, law enforcement did not find any GHB. But they hit the jackpot when they found his stash of photos and videos, which showed Lester raping unconscious women. One woman in the set of photos was Andrew Lester's ex-girlfriend, Tanya. Police reached out to Tanya to let her know what they found. Tanya met Lester in October 1996 on the State Street College Strip in Santa Barbara. She quickly moved into his house, but realized something was wrong with Lester when she discovered his cache of creepy, sexualized pictures. He had a collage that consisted of many naked women, which was displayed on a wall in the back room of his house. After a short time, there was a picture of Tanya that was added to that collage. The couple parted on bad terms. Lester had given her $4,000 so she could have her teeth fixed, but he sued her to get the money back after the breakup. The relationship only lasted 3 months. In 2000, when police showed Tanya the tape Lester made of her, she was at a different place in life. Tanya was married, pregnant, and expecting twins. She thought the video was from the night she and Lester first met. He apparently drugged her and took her back to his house. Lester was seen on the video putting Tanya's limp body into various positions. He inserted several objects inside of her and sodomized her. Tanya told police that she had no idea they had intercourse on that first night or that anything had been videotaped. Law enforcement laid additional charges at Andrew Lester's feet. Tanya felt shocked by the whole situation and unfortunately lost one twin during the pregnancy. She felt finding out that she was drugged and raped played a role in losing her baby. Police found another victim named Shauna. She met Lester on the beach when she was only 16. The only thing she recalled doing was kissing him, but police found a video that Lester had labeled Shauna GHBing. The video shows Lester raping her when she was unconscious and snoring. Shauna was 17 at the time. On the video, Lester says he dreams about a strawberry blonde passing out in his bed, waiting for him to do what he wants. Lester received more charges. Additionally, 10 more women came forward and accused him of drugging and raping them. The prosecution went forward with the charges just for three victims, Carrie, Tanya, and Shauna, since they had the strongest cases. They charged Andrew Lester with over 80 various criminal counts, from rape to poisoning to drug possession. The judge set bail at $10 million, since Andrew Lester had extraordinary means to flee. The case was picked up quickly by the media due to the wealth of the defendant and his famous connection to the Max Factor cosmetics empire. Lester was in jail, feeling sorry for himself, while his defense team launched a campaign against the victims. Their goal was to sway the media into believing that the character of the victims was tarnished, especially Carrie's. They painted her as someone who felt regret for having sex with multiple men in one night. After all, Carrie's dress on the night of the rape had tested positive for trace levels of semen from three different men, and they said the charges against Lester were how she justified her behavior. The defense attorneys claim that their client was a victim of GHB hysteria. Lester told the news media that law enforcement jumped to conclusions and made him a GHB poster boy. He said if they had fully vetted Carrie, detectives would have discovered that she was a liar. Lester claimed that all the sex acts were consensual and all parties agreed to be videotaped. Lester said since Carrie had sex with David in his car and went skinny dipping in the ocean, plus joined him in the shower, that this amounted to proof of consent. Lester's lawyers called this case prosecutorial misconduct. They claimed that the victims were gold diggers who wanted in on the Max Factor family fortune. Since Tanya agreed to being videotaped one time, the defense declared that this was implied consent to any sex acts being videotaped. The defense made Lester out to be a budding porno film director who was using his girlfriends as research, and they were just pretending to be asleep in the videos. Lester and his attorneys felt that the case against him would fall apart without Carrie, since her lifestyle of partying, drinking, and men would not stand up to jury scrutiny. There were many theories that attempted to figure out why Andrew Lester might have perpetrated these crimes. He needed to control women. He had low self-esteem. He feared rejection. He was spoiled and always got his way. He had money and felt he was above the law. He had a fetish. Or he had a personality disorder. Either way, Andrew Lester had enough charges where he could spend the rest of his life in prison if he were convicted. We're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsors. Thank you to Best Fiends for sponsoring this episode of Beyond Contempt True Crime. Podcast listeners, let me tell you about Best Fiends. It's an engaging puzzle game that everyone is playing. It's a laid-back game that you play on your phone. I've even played it on my iPad before. Well, mostly because I like to pretend that I don't need progressive lenses. But Best Fiends keeps adding new levels and events all the time, so the game is always popping. It's a great game to play when I need to take a break from researching podcast episodes. And you don't even need to be tethered to Wi-Fi, because you can play without an internet connection, which is great for me because my internet provider sometimes lets me down. Trust me, you really don't want to miss out on this game. Join me and the millions of people who are already playing this fun puzzle game. Download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Hi, everyone. I really need to tell you about BetterHelp Online Counseling. It's an affordable service where you can connect with one of their licensed professional therapists. You can find counselors that specialize in just about anything, including anxiety, depression, family conflicts, trauma, and LGBTQ issues. I work from home and barely leave my house, so it's great that you can communicate with your counselor from the privacy of your own home. BetterHelp is more affordable than traditional in-person counseling, and financial aid is available. So many people have been using BetterHelp that they are recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states, and you can start talking with your counselor in less than 24 hours. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting betterhelp.com/beyondcontempt. Join over 1 million people taking charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp.com/beyondcontempt. Now, back to the show. Andrew Lester had been in jail for about 5 months, and on appeal, the court ruled that his $10 million bond was not reasonable, so they reduced it to $1 million. He came up with the $700,000, and his mother came up with the remaining $300,000. Lester was made to wear a GPS monitor on his ankle and was supposed to stay home unless he had an essential errand. They let him out of prison right before Christmas in 2000. 2 months later, the preliminary hearing from his case was underway, and Tanya, Shauna, and Carrie all provided testimony. The defense argued that all the women willingly took GHB because it was part of the raver lifestyle, and all the sexual acts were consensual, even the unconscious ones. The prosecution called it what it was. They saw a man on the video who enjoyed raping and assaulting younger, unconscious women. At the end of the hearing, the judge ruled that there was adequate evidence for the case to go to trial. He also said that what happened to Carrie was best understood in the context of what happened to both Tanya and Shauna, meaning that none of this was consensual. This took the wind out of the defense, who thought that the case would fall apart. They tentatively set the trial for fall 2002, and Lester's legal team pressed to lighten up his house arrest restrictions and said he needed more freedom to prepare for trial. The prosecution was against this and worried that Lester was a flight risk, since money was no object for his family. The judge ruled in favor of loosening up restrictions and allowed Andrew Lester full freedom from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. His ankle bracelet would only alert police if he were not in his home from 8 p.m. to 8 a.m. If Lester fled, he would have a 12-hour head start on law enforcement. Andrew Lester's trial began on December 16, 2002. All the sex tapes were viewed by the jurors, and they also heard victim testimony. The judge called a 2-week recess before Christmas so everyone could take a holiday break. The trial resumed on January 3, 2003, but the defendant did not show up. The judge made a grave error, and Lester now had a head start on law enforcement. A warrant for Andrew Lester was issued by the FBI for the unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. Lester fleeing was not a spontaneous event. It was clear that he carefully planned his escape. Lester withdrew money from some of his brokerage accounts, arranged for someone to care for his dog, had his mail forwarded, and packed like he was planning for an extended stay trip. The trial moved forward without Andrew Lester. The jury watched a videotape of Lester talking with a detective on the day he was arrested. He was overconfident and insisted that everything was consensual. "Carrie loved every minute of it," he declared. To the detective, he characterized Carrie as someone who had endless and excessive sexual desires. Lester's fleeing crushed any chance that the jury would find him innocent, and the criminal charges against him would not likely be reduced. The defense's plan had been to put Lester on the stand, but now they had to resort back to their earlier strategy, stating that the sex was consensual, the women willingly took JHB, and they were pretending to be asleep in the videos. Lester's attorneys did not have many cards to play, so they made out like he was a character in the movie The Fugitive. They said that Andrew was an innocent man and was on the run because he was wrongly convicted. But juries know innocent men don't run, so the tactic was preposterous. The jury went out on deliberation, and it took them 2 days to reach a verdict, since they had to sift through so many charges. They found Lester guilty on over 80 charges. The jury only butted heads on one of the smaller poisoning complaints and couldn't come to a consensus. They found Andrew Lester guilty on 20 counts of drug-induced rape, 17 counts of raping an unconscious victim, and multiple counts of sodomy and oral copulation by use of drugs. The defense team said that they would appeal the conviction. Lester's sentencing was a month later, and law enforcement still could not locate him. The three victims, Carrie, Tanya, and Shauna, were disappointed that Lester was not there to face them for their impact statements, as they felt deeply damaged and violated by his actions. Tanya said that she had problems sleeping at night. Shauna commented on Lester's lack of remorse and how she would have to live with this for the rest of her life. The defense team tried to delay the sentencing, but the judge pressed forward. He said that Mr. Lester could attend court if he wanted, but he chose not to. The judge sentenced Andrew Lester to consecutive 6-year sentences for each of the 20 counts of rape, plus another 4 years for the poisoning. This amounted to 124 years in prison. The judge also imposed a $1 million fine that Lester was to pay into a California Crime Victims Restitution Fund. The hunt for Andrew Lester was in full swing. Law enforcement believed that he might have headed to Mexico. Lester was familiar with Mexico and spent many vacations there surfing. He had even owned a home on the beachfront at one time. But the FBI wasn't the only entity that was looking for Andrew Lester. Bounty hunters were also tracking him and were a few steps ahead of the FBI. Lester had been living his normal beach bum lifestyle. He stayed in cheap hotels by the ocean so he could surf during the day and party at the clubs at night. This was literally the same lifestyle he lived in California prior to being arrested. The hotel manager had pleasant things to say about Andrew Lester. He was friendly, cultured, and spoke fluent Spanish. The manager even gave Lester a friends and family discount because he remembered him from prior trips. This was already a Hollywood story of cosmetic moguls and spoiled trust fund kids But it turned into a bona fide true crime Hollywood tale when Dwayne Chapman, better known as Dog the Bounty Hunter, and his crew tackled Andrew Luster as he ordered street tacos from a roadside stand by the Pacific Coast Beach Resort in Puerto Vallarta. American tourists who had known Luster had tipped Chapman off, and Luster was living under the assumed name of David Carrera. Witnesses saw Luster's capture go down. Chapman and his crew threatened him with tear gas, wrestled him to the ground, cuffed him, and stuffed him in a vehicle. The bounty hunter team drove away in two cars while declaring success. The capture rattled the locals, and some taxi drivers notified the police. The Mexican authorities caught up with Chapman just outside of town, and everyone in Chapman's crew was arrested. Back in 1990, American authorities used bounty hunters to capture a doctor who was involved in prolonging the life of a DEA agent in Mexico. As a result, the agent was tortured longer before he was eventually murdered. Mexico made bounty hunting illegal within their country. Luster was handed over to the FBI. Dwayne Chapman, his son, his grandson, his cameraman, and another person on his team were all put in a Mexican jail. The FBI said that they would have gotten Luster eventually, as the same couple who tipped off Chapman tipped them off as well. The FBI didn't offer any help to Chapman to get out of jail, since they would have captured Luster without his help. As Chapman sat behind bars, he told reporters to say hello to his wife, and that he was being treated well by Mexican authorities. Chapman really wanted to collect the bail money for capturing Luster, which was reported to be $150,000. The Ventura County Sheriff didn't think that any of the bail money would go to Chapman and his crew, but they might have been eligible for a $10,000 reward. Dwayne Chapman and his team were eventually bailed out for $300, and his lawyers told them to flee Mexico immediately. Chapman was charged with felony kidnapping, but they reduced it to a misdemeanor. He thought his pursuit of Luster into Mexico was legal since he was working with a Mexican police officer. An American judge ruled that Chapman was not entitled to any of the bond or reward money. Dwayne Chapman was lucky because sometimes bounty hunters are sued, beaten, or shot when they leave their home country of origin to bounty hunt in other nations that have differing laws. Andrew Luster kept a journal while he was hiding out in Mexico. The journal had been left in his hotel room and found its way into the hands of the Ventura County Star, which was Luster's local newspaper. Some of the journal was mundane and contained to-do lists that reminded him to dye his hair and beard. Luster had written down pickup lines in Spanish, but some of the other entries were more serious, and it was clear he was attempting to justify his crimes and wanted retribution against his victims. His list of people to pay back included Carrie, Tanya, and Shauna, plus the prosecutor and the detectives who interviewed him prior to his arrest. Luster called them government robots. He even sketched a paragraph in third-person point of view, which read, "They were trying to do him in for having sex with two of his past girlfriends. Lock him up forever for being with two girls he had slept with 100 times each." Yes, they were in an extreme state of inebriation and a vid. But this, as any actively sexual person knows, is not outside the grounds of ethical play. Luster wanted to appeal his conviction, but fugitives forfeit their right to appeal. He claimed he received conflicting advice from his attorneys. One encouraged him to plead guilty, one told him to fight the charges, and a third attorney, Richard Sherman, told him to flee to Mexico. Luster sued Sherman for $6 million in 2004. Sherman said the lawsuit was ridiculous, and Andrew Luster was in the habit of blaming everyone but himself. Dwayne Chapman said Sherman was the one who tipped him off about Luster fleeing to Mexico. Chapman claimed that Sherman asked him if he spoke Spanish and reminded Chapman that Luster also spoke Spanish. At the time, Chapman had leads that pointed to Thailand and Mexico. He shifted gears and focused all his efforts on Mexico. Sherman has always denied this and passed away in April 2011, so he can no longer defend his position. Andrew Luster's original sentence was for 124 years. Per California law, they required him to serve at least 85% of that time before he would be parole eligible, which would have been 105 years. Luster's legal team filed a petition for habeas corpus to have his case reviewed, and the petition was granted in April 2012. On March 11, 2013, the court vacated his 124-year sentence, but his conviction remained intact. On April 16, 2013, a new judge reduced his sentence to 50 years, 48 years for the rape charges and 2 years for the drug-related charges. The judge did not buy the argument that Luster's attorneys failed him or convinced him to flee. Luster was grateful, and the new sentence brought him to tears as he thanked the judge. Andrew Luster's mother, Elizabeth, told the judge that her son was decent, honest, and kind. She thought he handled himself well through this nightmare. In civil court, they ordered Luster to pay $40 million to Tanya and Shauna. Luster had purportedly spent most of his fortune paying for his own legal defense. He sold most of his property and declared bankruptcy. Tanya and Shauna's legal teams had their hands full, trying to follow the money trail of the Max Factor Luster family balance sheet. Elizabeth Luster had a lawsuit of her own and was trying to recover the bail money that was taken when her son fled to Mexico. The lawsuit stated that her lawyer was incompetent and it had cost her $1 million. All the money in the Max Factor empire could not buy Andrew Luster his freedom. He is currently incarcerated at the Valley State Prison in Chowchilla, California. Thank you so much for joining me for this episode of Beyond Contempt. Please visit beyondcontemptpodcast.com for the links to the sources and music used in this episode. Research, writing, editing, audio production, and music scoring were performed by me, Renee. If you like the show, please leave me a favorable review in Apple Podcasts. Thank you so much, everyone. I'm a serial charmer, you'd say. Who knew I'd be dizzy with the dame when the bad boys are on parade? I offend my honor with my faith until I finally kiss the pleasant side of life's wicked give and take. Contrary, bone-dressed Eric Cool in my wild cherry. This is my favorite dream. Won't wait the minute I'd be. Selfish with all the you.
you.